First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
A new investigation, yet again, into the failed JEA sale. Defunding of diversity programs at Florida's colleges. Local sheriffs weigh in on permitless carry. And a new study says the rent in Jacksonville is too darn high. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, our own Matt Shaw speaks with Susto frontman Justin Osborne, part of our JME, the Jacksonville Music Experience. All of that ahead, but first it's Friday, and here to round up all the week's news, we welcome Ben Becker of Action News Jax. Hey, Ben. We'll have Ben in a minute in studio. Claire, are you there, Ben?
I'm here.
Hey, Ben, good morning. In studio, Claire Goforth of The Daily Dot.
Good morning.
Joe McClain with Channel 4 WJXT, the local station.
Good morning.
And rounding out our fabulous foursome regular contributor, Fred Matthews.
Good morning, Melissa.
Hi, Fred. Folks, we're live on the radio and live on video stream. Watch us right now on Facebook and YouTube as we begin with our top story. This week, Jacksonville City Council President Terrence Freeman says he's reviving the Special Investigatory Committee on JEA Matters. The committee will meet next Wednesday. They're going to investigate whether they were deceived or misled by council member and mayoral candidate Leanna Cumber over any potential ties she had to the failed effort to sell off JEA. An attorney for Cumber calls the whole thing a political stunt. Cumber says she never intentionally deceived or misled the committee about any involvement her husband, Hussein Cumber, had in the potential sale of JEA. We're beginning the hour with a closer look at this. Of course, the mayor's election is coming up in March. Give us a call. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook always open. Ben Becker, let's begin with you. This story kicked up when the Times Union reported that Cumber's husband met and communicated with people working to move forward a proposal around selling JEA called Public Power Partners. She did not apparently disclose that to the committee that was investigating at the time. What do you make of this?
Well, first off, Melissa, the Cumber people maintain they did nothing wrong, that Leanna Cumber's husband wasn't paid as part of this. He was never hired. They never broke any laws. And that's what they're sticking with. Now, even the biggest Leanna Cumber supporter is going to have to admit the optics here aren't great. And they're going to have to manage that. They maintain this is politically motivated. The investigation is backed by Mayor Lenny Curry, Daniel Davis, and they're basically weaponizing city council to take down the Cumber campaign. Now, I've talked to people close to the campaign, and they tell me, listen, they're furious at this, and they have no qualms at this point, if not at this point down the line, these people who are close to the campaign, that this thing goes scorched earth, they're ready to do that if that's where Davis wants to take it. They also tell me that, Davis, they believe this is all because he's scared and that he's not polling well and he'll do anything he can to win. And they say, look, he only would poll better if he was running against Urban Meyer.
Oh, that's a low blow. 549-2937. Of course, Daniel Davis is the president of the Jacksonville Chamber of Commerce. He is a candidate for mayor. Both Davis and Cumber, the two most well-funded Republicans in the Jacksonville mayoral race, have been taking to local airwaves, each accusing the other of improper involvement in the failed effort to privatize JEA, Claire, which was exceedingly unpopular with the public and failed because of that. It sparked a federal investigation, a grand jury, indictments. That is all ongoing as we speak. Does this matter to voters when they go to cast a ballot in the March city elections, do you think, or not?
That is the takeaway question here. And full disclosure, my spouse works for JEA.
Right.
But, you know, it is really watching this mudslinging fest that we have going on between the Davis and Cumber campaigns. You know, it's a cynical campaign that we're seeing right now. And I think the voters, I don't know that the voters are really caring about this that much. I mean, it certainly is important for the public to know whether or not there was any omissions and to know, to get to the heart of the matter. But I think voters right now are probably concerned with their personal lives, such as the rising rent prices that we'll talk about mm-hmm. later this hour, crime, opportunity. This is a cynical campaign. It's not a campaign on either side that's about vision. It's a campaign about tearing down the other. And that's effective to a certain degree, but I don't see that it's going to increase voter turnout.
Mm.
Isn't that what we want? More engaged voters instead of people rehashing a news story from 3 years ago?
Yeah, Fred Matthews, this does go back several years. We, you know, will be seeing a few town halls with the mayoral candidates leading up to the election. I'm actually going to be moderating one next Tuesday night at the Interfaith Center. But yeah, I mean, we need to hear from these candidates about their vision for the city, too, not just relitigating what went on in the past.
Well, this is not about the turnout of voters, because certainly most voters have thought that the JEA issue was done. The only place that you read about anything related to JEA these days is in the column at the Times Union. But this is about the Republic, a rare look on the inside of the local Republican Party as they see, as some people in leadership there are seeking to cull the Republican herd come primary time. Because as we all know, it's whoever gets the most votes, the two top vote getters who get the most votes, assuming nobody gets more than 50%, those are the two that will go to the general election about a month or so later after the March primary. And this is about culling the herd a little bit. We're all able to see here is that is apparently who is favored by Republican leadership. And apparently, Ms. Cumber finds herself in a position of not necessarily being favored by the Republican leadership. Because why else would the Republican leadership of the city council decide to have a special reopen a committee on the JEA issue, which is already settled? If I'm not mistaken, the guy that led the whole debacle is already been grand juried and subject to trial and all of that. So this is a rare look at inside politics here locally. And unfortunately for Ms. Cumber, she is bearing the brunt of those who simply want her to get out.
Joe McClain, Channel 4. Let's talk about the whole mayoral field. On the Democratic side, we have Donna Deegan and Audrey Gibson, perennial candidate Omega Allen. And then on the Republican side, Daniel Davis, Leanna Cumber, and Al Ferraro, another council member. What about this? Is this an example of the local, critics would call it, machine coalescing behind their candidate in an attempt to force out the candidate they don't want?
And that also is a absolutely great question. And what I'll speak to is the fact that, yeah, it is a crowded field. And to the point about voter interest, voter engagement in this race, I bet if you went out onto the streets of Jacksonville and asked who are all those candidates that you just listed, who would be able to name
right.
all of them, maybe you wouldn't be able to get more than maybe just Cumber and Davis because of this. To the point of, is this a politically motivated investigation or mm-hmm. is this a legitimate thing that needs to be concluded? I'll say something can be two things. It
yeah.
can be, it can certainly be, this is something that I think should be looked into. Of course, I'm a journalist, so I'm always like, yes, investigate everything. but it also, look at the timing. I mean, look at the timing. And what this has done is put Davis and Cumber front and center. And what it has done is it's taken something that people do remember. It is, yeah, over. But people do remember the attempted sale of JEA. That is a potent thing that people recall. So bringing that into the race makes people, I believe it does make people perk up and say, wait, what?
Mm-hmm.
So it's effective.
You think it could move a few votes?
I certainly do think so.
Let us know your thoughts at 549-2937. Ben Becker, as you pointed out a minute ago, Cumber has said she was advised that she was not legally obligated to report any information about her husband's activities around JEA because he was a private citizen. She also said she feared the disclosure could affect a federal criminal investigation that was underway at the time. Ben.
Yeah, that's her position. That's what the campaign maintains. But like I said before, the optics are what the optics are. And, you know, when you splash that all over the place, you know, that could resonate with people. And the JEA issue has been put out there. And let's be frank about it. The Cumber campaign, or at least not the campaign directly, but those who support her drew first blood with the JEA issue with ads that they ran about Daniel Davis, maybe started, I don't know, maybe a month ago. So as you know, you draw first blood, you better be prepared to take it back. And now they're getting it back tenfold.
You know, at the same time, Claire Goforth, Chamber President and CEO Daniel Davis, was indirectly tied to the effort to sell JEA through the chamber paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to sponsor a summit on privatizing the utility. And Cumber has accused him of being too close to the privatization effort, too.
Well, of course he was. I mean, the Jack's Chamber members were the precisely the people who would benefit the most from a huge windfall should the city have sold JEA and taken, you know, billions of dollars that they would then dole out to these high dollar developers and other types of that nature who are very indelibly linked to the chamber. I mean, it was in his best interest as chamber president to do the bidding of the people that he was beholden to. And then, I mean, that's just a fact of the matter. And you can agree or disagree with it, but that's his job. Literally.
Fred Matthews, as this is all playing out and the two most well-funded Republicans are tearing each other to shreds, are the Democrats, Donna Deegan and Audrey Gibson, sitting back and breaking out the popcorn watching this happen?
That's all they can do, because this is a Republican fight. Neither of them are on the city council. They have anything to do with what may happen in committee in the coming week or so. So they're simply watching that. The key for them, everybody is looking at their percentage at this point. And right now, as we saw statistically, as we saw in the sheriff's race, it's about the Democrats splitting up enough votes among their partisans and among the Republicans. It's trying to gather as many of the Republican votes as they can on their side. So, yes, the Democratic candidates are sitting back. Their early comments have been fairly mature. There's nothing really for them to say. They haven't attacked each other yet on the Democrat side. We can expect that at some point. But so far, nothing but what we see on television.
Joe McClain.
I think, unfortunately, because of the political environment we're in, there is a significant portion, I think, of the voter base that will go into the polls and check R and whatever the candidate is. So
or
right
D,
now,
yeah, or,
it, R, R
or yeah, sure.
And right now, what we're seeing is, Leanna Cumber has name recognition because she sits on the council. Daniel Davis, I think, is establishing himself through his media presence, and you know he's been a very public person. But right now, I think this is sort of an effort to edge out the other R and so paint them in the minds, and so there's more distinguishing on who's in that column, and. You know, establish, you know, come out on top as the clear preference by painting the other one as, you know, corrupt or, you know.
We'll see what happens. One thing, though, we've noticed over the years with these local elections that typically go to runoffs is they can hold surprises. So let us know your thoughts. It's 549-2937, our Friday roundtable with Ben Becker, Claire Goforth, Fred Matthews, and Joe McClain. We're going to talk about another hot topic now. Will Floridians soon be able to carry concealed weapons without a permit? If the legislature and the governor have their way, yes, Florida could become the 26th state to pass what's called permitless carry legislation. Now, The Florida Sheriff's Association is supporting this, although sheriffs in both Central and South Florida have spoken out against it, saying it's dangerous and a bad idea. T.K. Waters, the Duval County Sheriff, and the sheriffs of Nassau and Clay counties say they support the legislation. Sheriff Waters in Jacksonville says he supports the right of law-abiding citizens to carry firearms. So as we talk about this, we want to hear from you, everybody. What do you think of this potential expansion of gun rights in Florida? You'd be able to carry a concealed loaded weapon on you with no permit and no training if this legislation becomes law. Give us a call. Let us know what you think at 549-2937. Ben Becker, you know, the polling on this is clear. In Florida, bipartisan majorities support reasonable restrictions on firearms while still supporting the First Amendment. So is this legislation going against the will of the voters overall?
It'll be interesting to see which way that goes. It's hard to interpret, you know, how people are going to react to this and where it could go. I mean, I remember, let me tell you a little story, Melissa. I was 8 years old and I got a toy gun from a friend and I brought it home and my mother was like, "You get rid of that thing right now." And I remember as clear as day. And so I've never been a big gun guy. But I respect people's rights to have guns. But I'll tell you what, you know, I bump around Florida and I bump around here. And anytime like, there's a parking spot or a lane change and somebody's having an issue or a problem, especially with like a parking spot, I'm like, dude, you could have it. I'm not going to get into any kind of confrontation over a parking spot because you never know if someone's carrying around here. So to the point of whether you could carry without a permit or not, you know, that's, I think for a lot of people, will be a lot of consternation, just considering the climate we live in, you know, usually on a daily basis.
Claire Goforth, House Speaker Paul Renner, he's from our area down in Palm Coast. He announced this measure. He's sponsoring the bill. He says, "We're removing the government permission slip to require a permit to exercise a constitutional right." Down in South Florida, lawmakers who represent the constituents around Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School say things like removing training to make you a competent firearm carrier is not a great public safety measure.
Well, studies have shown that the states that pass what they like to call constitutional carry legislation that removes any requirement to get a permit experience an increase in violent crime, mass shootings, all of these gun-related deaths. And is that something that we want to see in Jacksonville, which is just typically the murder capital of Florida? As you mentioned earlier, a majority of Americans, a majority of Floridians do think there should be some reasonable restrictions. Do we want people walking around Jacksonville shooting themselves in the foot? What about people that are in domestic violence situations? Do we want their spouse to just so easily be able to tuck a gun into their belt and do the unthinkable? I mean, these are very real repercussions that happen when people can just carry guns. And I realize that a law doesn't stop people from breaking it, but it does stop law enforcement from doing anything about it when there's in the absence of a law.
For those who've lost loved ones to gun violence, Fred, this announcement this week was particularly painful given that it is National Gun Violence Survivors Week this week. And it's also this month, the 5-year anniversary of the mass shooting in Parkland. Fred.
Unfortunately, as I've said before and has been noted, this is the government we elected. When you elect an uber conservative Second Amendment government in place and you have a governor in place who has no fear, especially since he doesn't have to face the voters here again, all of the agenda items, all of the conservative agenda items that are on the slate are going to be moved up, and this is just the latest of them. They have indicated everything from if you want to, you know, stop a guy with a gun, you know, a bad guy with a gun, the best thing is have a good guy with a gun. And they simply are not concerned about these rather liberal to moderate concerns that we have. The idea is that if I want to have a gun, I should be able to get it. And if I want to carry it secretly. Rather, I don't see the reason why you should have to carry it secretly. I think you should have it on your waistline so everybody can see it, and we'll be just like it was in the 1800s. Everybody walks around with a gun on their hip. That's the easiest thing to do. But this secret carry business is just one more thing that's on the conservative agenda. And, folks, there's nothing you can do about it because it's going to pass. Government's going to sign it.
Now, he referenced open carry, Joe. There is some resistance to doing what Fred just described, letting everyone just carry their guns openly in public, all because people who even support permitless carry in the legislature have said we're a state dependent on tourism, and that would not be attractive to some tourists. That said, there's a chance we could eventually see open carry legislation in Florida as well. What about the arguments for this legislation?
Well, one thing I will mention about open carry is when I talked to the sheriffs this week, you mentioned Sheriff Bill Leeper and Sheriff Michelle Cook. Both of them basically kind of gave the exact same statement to a almost, if I was a college professor, I would call it plagiarism. I'm assuming they drew the statement from the sheriff's department, but it was almost word for word.
The Florida Sheriff's Association.
Florida Sheriff's Association.
They support this.
Me, yes. T.K. Waters, though, he said he does not support, he was very clear, he does not support open carry, which was very interesting, an open carry provision. I will speak, though, to some of the statements saying law-abiding citizens are not the problem. You know, concealed carry is not a problem. Yeah, well, no one is hurt by someone concealed carrying. It's what happens after that. It's what happens when the concealed carry is drawn out and there's a confrontation because of, as Ben Becker said, a parking space thing or something. The people who I think are legitimately carrying weapons as a means of protection, which a lot of people support, a lot of people understand and support that. Some people don't. That's okay. But like the idea of I want a weapon when I'm out on the street because I want to be able to protect myself. I don't know what's going to happen out there. I want to protect myself. That's a real, you know, legitimate instinct, I think, on people's part. But those people who say I don't want to have to get any training or any type of permit, that's too much of a burden. I think that's where you cross over into, well, what is this really about? Training?
As it stands now, if you're a Florida resident, you must complete a training course to receive a concealed carry permit. Eliminating the permit requirement would do away with mandatory training to hold a weapon. Let's go to some calls. Lots of calls at 549-2937. Chris in Mandarin. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hey, I am all for people having firearms. I have several, but I'm telling you, it is an absolute mistake to arm the public untrained. And I agree with the gentleman before who said a better choice would be open carry, because then people can see. But at the same time, I believe if you purchase a weapon, just like if you purchase any other piece of equipment that you need to be trained in, you should have to be trained in it. And that's it. These are dangerous tools. And in the wrong hands of people who don't know what they're doing, there's going to be a lot of blood. There just simply is. And that's sad because it doesn't take that much to figure out how to use these things. And just a little bit of training would go a long way.
Thank you, Chris. I'm having trouble dropping people on the phone. There you go, Chris. Leo in Ponte Vedra. Go ahead, Leo. Hi, Leo. Go ahead. All right, Leo, give us a call back. Michael on the north side. How are you, Michael?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to comment on both the concealed weapons and the open carry. First of all, I have my concealed weapons permit, and I think to allow someone to carry a weapon without any training is ridiculous, it's reckless, and it's dangerous. There's so much information that you're given when you take that course. There's so much that I didn't know before I took that course. You learn where you can legally carry, where you cannot legally carry. You learn what situations and circumstances that you can legally pull a weapon on a person and what you cannot do. So for a person to not be armed with that information but be armed with a deadly weapon, that is extremely dangerous and reckless. And then the second point is on the open carry. To me, I think that's also a dangerous situation, because as it stands now, when a person, anybody, in a person, if a person is out in the general public and they see a gun, they automatically know red flag danger. You know that something bad is about to happen. But if you allow people to openly carry and you're walking around with guns, I don't know what situation is potentially dangerous or what person is a quote unquote good guy with a gun. How can I distinguish between the two? I can't. So I think that's a crazy idea as well. But again, both are silly to me. I don't understand. And I hope they don't happen. Thank you.
All right, Michael. Thank you. Vicky in St. Augustine. Hi, Vicky.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning. I mean, it's just like beating your head against a wall. You know, rational people who follow the data and know the statistics know that it's such a bad idea that it's just so frustrating. You know, when you know what has happened, how many mass shootings do we need? It's embarrassing in this country. And then also wanted to say there was a gentleman who called in yesterday who made such a good point to me that he said most people – not most, some people who preach about the Second Amendment and their rights, they forget that very important first part that is well-regulated. And I don't think this bill means well-regulated. To me, it means it's a free-for-all. And, you know, it's scary. It's very scary. And with just road rage could trigger somebody. And, you know, the sad state of affairs. That's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Jason in San Marco. Hello, Jason.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. I agree with everyone who's called in. This is a ridiculous idea, and this should be put to the Florida voters on the ballot in 2024. Let the citizens of Florida decide if they want to run around in a shooting gallery or not. And the arguments against it are how onerous and what a difficulty it is to get the permit. That is exactly the point. You know, do the policemen have training on firearms, or do we hand them a weapon on day one and say, good luck, guys. Hope you can figure this out on duty. This is stupid. And I tell you, if they had the character and the courage to put it on the ballot, it would be turned down by the citizens of Florida. And that's why they won't put it on the ballot. I want to make one other comment. We had a six-year-old shoot a teacher somewhere in this country. Now, imagine if the Republicans had gotten their way and the teacher was armed. Would that teacher have shot and killed that six-year-old when he drew a weapon on her? Weapons are not working in this country the way they are being held so irresponsibly. And once again, thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Oh, boy, so many calls. Let's try to get a few more of you in. We have Leo back in Ponte Vedra now. Go ahead, Leo.
Hey, good morning. This is so wrong in so many levels, but just one point I want to make. Do you think people, you know, Florida, it depends a lot on tourism. Do you think people from other countries are going to be, I want to come to Florida when they know everybody's armed? I mean, that's ridiculous. What is the governor thinking?
Let's talk about that. Of course, we are a heavily armed state as it stands, but what about the tourism part of this argument? Claire.
Well, I mean, Florida is the 26th state to pass this type of legislation, mm-hmm. so I don't know that it will have a measurable impact on tourism, but it may if we see an increase in gun violence, as we are likely to see. But the caller does make a good point about tourism. Do tourists really want to come to a state if we do pass that open carry legislation that some would advocate for, where they walk in? I mean, I've flown into places where there are guards with automatic weapons in the airport, and it's very scary to see that. And I grew up around guns. I'm from West Virginia. My parents are gun owners. I'm a gun owner. I was taught how to shoot a gun when I was 11 or 12 years old, around the age where you can actually physically handle one. I don't have an issue with guns, but the reason that my parents taught me how to safely handle a gun is because they're so dangerous. I can't drive a motorcycle without a special license or a car. And in a motorcycle, you have a more likelihood of killing yourself than anybody else. So what does it make sense that I can carry a gun in my pocket that could take out how many people, you know, 20 at a time?
Al in St. Augustine. Hi, Al. What say you?
Oh, first of all, I think it's a stupid idea. And I think it's just a political deal now to get the gun owners to vote Republican. Whatever the case is, how is a law enforcement officer to know that Joe Schmidt is pulling a gun out of his holster at his side? How does the law enforcement officer know whether or not this guy is going to shoot somebody that he's angry with? And, you know, we keep hitting the police to saying, well, the police officer said he felt threatened. Is a police officer going to feel more threatened now because there's every Tom, Dick, and Harry carrying a gun? We're back to the Wild West, which is ridiculous. We have law enforcement officers to protect people. Let them put the money into hiring more law enforcement officers and stop this Wild West garbage of everybody's going to have a six-shooter at a side 24/7. That's bound to be used, and it's going to kill people unnecessarily.
Thank you, Al. Tamara in St. Mary's, Florida. Hi, Tamara.
Hey there. So I don't know if anyone has said it yet, but I personally feel that this is politicians who cannot say no to the NRA.
All right. Thanks for that. Here's a comment on Facebook. Tom says, I'll be saying goodbye forever to my Florida home for the past 28 years if permitless carry passes. And I'm not the only one I know. Good luck, folks, he says. Of course, as Claire pointed out, half the states have passed this kind of legislation already. On Facebook, Mary says, we just saw this happen on a movie set. Rust, Alec Baldwin is facing charges because he accidentally shot someone with a gun on a movie set. He was not trained in the use of the weapon. Why are we not going to train people and just let them run wild on the streets? Fred Matthews, you know, it does bring to mind that story involving actor Alec Baldwin. Apparently he declined weapons training on that movie set, and he is now facing manslaughter charges.
And I don't think there's anybody around who thinks that he intentionally shot that the director of the of the show and the producer of it, but nonetheless the laws in that state and the prosecutor on the case has determined that somebody is going to be held responsible for this, and both Baldwin and the armor bearer are the ones that are going to be front and center on this here in Florida. That simply is not a concern with many folks who lead the Republican Party and with the legislators who've long been waiting for this opportunity to put this kind of legislation in front of it. And you can see the difference in opinion between North Florida sheriffs and those in South Florida sheriffs who face down gangsters and criminals multiple more times than their face, believe it or not here in North Florida. It's not a concern in Palatka. It's not a concern in Old Town, Florida. It's not a concern in Quincy because they don't have that kind of, quote, criminal element going on. But can you imagine that how well this is going to do for the Sherwood boys over there in Sherwood Forest and some of the other street gang members that we have here, when they know that it's legal for them to carry a gun now? It will be legal for them to carry a gun. These will be the unintended consequences of this. And they will have permits, but they will be legally able to carry their guns if this legislation passes. It's not just for some folks. It's not for middle class and upper class. This will be everybody. And that includes people with criminal intent. And those that don't, and this won't be people with mental problems. These will be people who have the right to commit, who have the right to carry the gun, and their purpose is to commit crimes. And we're saying it's okay for you to carry, to keep that gun under your jacket. And as the caller said, how's the police officer to determine when they do pull their gun out, whether they're going to be pulling it out to shoot them or pulling it out to lay it down?
Lots of calls. We're going to take a few more of you and then move on. Mark in Mandarin. Hi, Mark. What do you think?
Good morning, Melissa and team. My question is, or my thought is that while there appears to be a lot of news coverage about armed citizens defending themselves, I judge those to be anecdotal. What I have not seen is actually empirical research and evidence that suggests that the more armed citizens there are, that there's a reduction in crime. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, the data shows the opposite, actually. Joe McClain.
Right. The study that was in part of my reporting this week, this is from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and this was last year. It found that the average rate of assaults with firearms increased by an average of 9.5%. Now, that data was taken across 36 states that had eased concealed carry laws. Now, that's either outright passing permitless carry or changing language that really weakens the gun laws. So that is 9.5%. And again, I want to say that's assaults with firearms. That's from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Another thing I do want to say, the term, and this was part of my reporting as well, the term constitutional carry has been used to describe this type of policy for a long time. That is a political term because mm-hmm. it implies that this is the only interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, when really there is certainly not consensus to that fact.
Caitlin in Green Cove Springs. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi. Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
You know, as somebody who was raised around guns, my dad was a firearms instructor, you know, so we were raised with a lot of safety. I think that this is just completely irresponsible and arbitrary, but, you know, knowing the political climate in Florida, it's going to pass. And I think that if they're going to do something like this, where we have, you know, the Stand Your Ground law, which essentially works as a legal loophole for people who are going to want to, you know, do whatever they want to do. I think there needs to be a stipulation saying that if you're going to carry, you have to have a personal liability insurance policy so that people are thinking before they act with these weapons.
Thanks for that. You know, we carry auto insurance really for the similar reason. If you harm someone with your vehicle, insurance will cover costs. And just before we move on, this is the trend in a number of states. If Florida passes this, it will become the 26th state. Gun safety groups are sounding the alarm about this, saying that states that implement this kind of permitless carry have upticks in both gun violence and police shootings. The organization Everytown for Gun Safety analyzed it and found that handgun homicides rose by 11%. In states that weakened their gun permitting regulations, police shootings increased at about the same rate. So those are the data. We'll continue to cover it, but we took up a lot of time on this, so I do need to move on and talk about another big story from the week. A new report out this week looking at the state of the rental housing crisis in Jacksonville. This is from UNF's Jack's Rental Housing Project. And it finds that nearly half the city's renters are cost burdened. Ben Becker, that means they're paying more than 30% of their monthly income in rent, which is not a good situation. Ben.
Yeah, Melissa, the rent's too damn high.
Yeah, like the book says. Before,
right?
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's too damn high. And it's not going down anytime soon. You know, once those prices go up, it takes a while for them to go down, if at all. Now, home prices have dropped some of the, with the inflationary pressures, they're being relieved. But still, that being said, this is an impossible situation right now for residents. You know, if you own your home and inflation is high, it doesn't change your mortgage payment. You're still paying the same amount of money. But for someone who rents, inflation goes up and the costs go up for the landlord, but that comes down to you. And those costs don't just dissipate overnight. And I don't know how anybody right now could be able to pay 50% more for their rent than what they used to pay, because no one's making 50% more money.
Yeah, exactly right. And Claire Goforth, this report points the finger at one bad actor in particular, institutional investors, that the report defines as predatory. They're gobbling up properties all over Florida, making rent and mortgages less affordable for millions of people.
Yes, I mean, I noted that the report found that Jacksonville was one of top two markets in the country for investor purchased homes. And those investors are just going to squeeze the tenants for as much of their hard-earned dollars as they can. And meanwhile, as you intimated, wages aren't going up. So people who have seen an rent increase, this blew me away, honestly, that tenants saw their rent increase between $370 and $470 per month from 2020 to 2022. How do people afford that? I mean, you're talking about up to about $6,000 a year. For someone who's making $35,000, that increase is unconscionable.
Yeah. I mean, Fred, this report pointed out that per the Duval County property appraiser, 25% of all single family homes in Duval are now owned by these corporate investors. 25%.
Yeah. When they see those ads on television where they're advertising that they'll buy your home without an inspection, they'll buy your home no matter what condition it's in. And those are the corporate investors that we're talking about. Those are their corporate entities behind these commercials that are offering to buy these homes, fix them up minimally, and put them back on the market for rent at exorbitant prices. And it's a great thing. For the last year and a half, I've been having email conversations with the former candidate who ran for Congress in the what was then the 4th District. And the gentleman happened to be about, he and his wife happened to be about 70 years old. They've been renting at this apartment complex for the last, 15, 20 years, and with the same company. About a year and a half ago, his old landlord, private company locally, sold to a national investor. Immediately after it was sold, within months, days after it was sold, he got a rent increase of $300 over what, which was usually annually, you might see a 2-3% increase, but this one amounted to close to a 10-12% increase in his rent. He's gone to court trying to sue. He's tried to get his councilman involved in helping them to pass some rent control legislation, but I got to tell you, what do we have here in Florida? What do we believe here in Florida now? We believe in capitalism. We believe in a free market economy. And we don't believe, when I say we, our government leaders, don't believe in putting restraints on companies from what they can charge. It's competitive. So this isn't going to stop anytime soon because we don't have any legislative appetite to stop it. There'll be no rent control south of the Mason-Dixon line.
Mm. And of course, that's the opposite of what this report is recommending, Joe McClain. The Jacks Rental Housing Project says local officials need to start monitoring and regulating institutional investors, and they need to create a tenant's bill of rights, which some other Florida cities have looked to do.
That's really, like, when you think about it, the only solution here, because when you if I'm working at a job and I don't like the way I'm being treated or you know, the policies are changing or they're paying me less and less, I can leave. People can, you know, in many cases strike. But you can't strike from housing. I mean, do you see like a whole neighborhood full
of people, need.
Right, yeah. walking out of their house and say, I'm going to be homeless now out of protest? That's not an option. There's an option to maybe lower your standard of living and go to a smaller, you know, tinier apartment in a more problematic neighborhood or a neighborhood you wouldn't want or something like that. But even those prices are still going up because this is a rising tide. So there's no option for renters or prospective home buyers. I mean, I'm 32 years old and I've given up on the idea right as of in any nearby future
that's
of buying a
that's
home.
That's the tragedy of it, is younger adults seeing home ownership slipping away. And I'm glad you pointed that out. And local officials, you know, they're going to be asked to respond to this report. We'll see what they do with it. Before we say goodbye, though, let's go around the horn. It's our lightning round. What else is on your mind this week, Ben Becker?
Melissa, first weekend in 6 months, there's no football. What are you going to do?
What are you going to do with yourself? I don't know.
Watch a retrospective of Tom Brady, the icon, the legend, the American hero who retired this week. That's our only choice of the nation.
You could go see 80 for Brady. How about that?
That's right. There you go.
Claire Goforth.
Yes, thank you, Tom Brady, for two fantasy football championships this year. I'm going to reiterate what I heard at the top of the hour because I want to see a lot of participation from our local residents in the Jumbo Shrimps audition to sing the national anthem.
Oh, right.
Come on, Jackson Villains. You have got the pipes. Let's do it.
That's right. Go do that. Fred Matthews.
I'm busy trying to figure out who my city councilman is and who am I. For.
Yeah, who can say?
Especially over there in District 4. I understand Rockman Johnson is running again for city council. Just got to figure out what side of the line he's going to live on.
Joe McClain.
I always bring this in for lightning round, and it's National What Day? So today is National Women's Physician Day. So that's important. Like any women physician that you know, give them a hug. Also, it's National Carrot Cake Day, which I absolutely love. So
My carrot cake.
And if you
my
eat
favorite.
Too much carrot cake, then go see a woman physician. That's what I say.
There you go. Thank you, Ben Becker, Claire Goforth, Fred Matthews, and Joe McClain. Thank you all.
Thanks, Melissa.
And join us today at noon for the Florida Roundup and this Saturday at 4 for What's Health Got to Do With It with Dr. Joe Servin. In a moment, we'll go inside JME, our Jacksonville Music Experience, as we speak with singer Justin Osborne of Susto. That's next.
This week on Science Friday, one of the hardest parts of being human is experiencing grief for lost loved ones.
On the one hand, you know that they're gone, but on the other hand, it sort of feels like they're going to walk through the door again.
We explore how grief rewires the brain on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Mourners gather in Memphis to remember Tyree Nichols as doubts grow over police records that are at odds with video recorded by the officers' own body cams. Also,
there's only one way forward here.
The Fed raises interest rates again and weighs in on raising the debt ceiling. And an epic ice storm leaves hundreds of thousands without power across the South. More on the Roundup next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, if you listen to The Independent 89.9 HD4, our music discovery station, you've probably heard Susto. Fronted by singer and guitarist Justin Osborne, the Charleston, South Carolina indie Americana band Susto has a big following, and they've received critical praise from major music publications, especially from their 2021 album, Time in the Sun. Now, Susto plays the beer hall at Intuition Ale Works Sunday, right down the street from us here at WJCT. Our arts and culture editor, Matt Shaw, spoke with Justin Osborne about songwriting for the latest installment of Liner Notes.
After nearly a decade of crafting introspective songs as Susto, Justin Osborne wrote his most personal record to date. On 2021's Time in the Sun, the Charleston, South Carolina-bred singer-songwriter and guitarist unpacks, at times, contradictory ideas of hope and despair.
Cause I'm on the ground in the streets and my hands in my face.
Yeah, Time in the Sun was written during the early onset of what has become an open-ended global pandemic. And while universal themes like the inner conflict of uncertainty permeate the record, Time in the Sun also includes Osborne's own personal reflections on the circle of life after a year in which he lost both his father and became a new dad himself. Osborne and his band perform as Susto on Sunday, February 5th at Intuition Aleworks. and he's here to talk about Time in the Sun for our latest edition of Liner Notes. Hey, Justin, thanks for being here.
Hey, Matt, thanks so much for having me, man. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So Time in the Sun is the follow-up to Ever Since I Lost My Mind. It's been described as a deeply personal record. Can you talk about any ways that those circle of life experiences, specifically losing your father, becoming a dad, influenced the writing of the record?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like my third record, Ever Since I Lost My Mind, like I think was me dealing a lot with just being on the road. The pandemic kind of hit, you know, in early 2020, and we were had come just begun to work on Time in the Sun. And I'd recently become a dad, like in June 2019, I'd become a dad to my little girl. And then like kind of early on in the pandemic, around May of 2020, my own father passed away. And so like I was just kind of like had these new, like really big kind of life experiences that were very much things that I was processing just as a human being, but also were showing up in my songwriting. I was, you know, dealing with the loss of a parent, and my dad and I were pretty close. And then also just like the new responsibility and like all the things you want to say to a new child, you know, like, but you can't say like at that. I mean, my daughter's 3 and a half now, but even, you know, when she was really young, it's like I had so much I wanted to tell her and I couldn't. And so I started writing.
I feel good right now. Outside in the autumn daytime. I love my life. I feel like I am finally making my way down the river towards Avalon.
Let's talk about the song Life is Suffering. That phrase, I think some would attribute to Buddha for sure. It's
right.
The first noble truth. Does that reference speak to the emotional journey you were on when putting together this album?
Yeah, for sure. It definitely does. I mean, as I told you, I was kind of like going through all these things that like part of it was painful, but part of it was beautiful, but all of it was hard.
You smell like salt and cotton balls baked in the high blue sun. The river runs wide and crooked at times, swells up with the hurricane rain. I don't mind, it doesn't happen all the time. I was born to bear a hurricane. I was born to bear a hurricane.
For me, this song just reminds me of South Carolina, and I grew up in South Carolina, you know, right in the way of hurricanes and dealing with, you know, the rivers swelling up and all this stuff, and also just like growing up working in construction around these old like salty guys who like just, you know, they're smoking cigars as the sun's coming up, and they have like the sweat of the day before kind of still on them, and like, and it's just very like visceral memories I have. But for me, like that song was like reaching deep back into my like memories of just like splashes of these things, you know, growing up around like what home and the bittersweetness of home means, you know, like the suffering of it all, but also like the beauty of memory and kind of like a breeze on a day, you know.
Covered in the pool boy's blood, but nobody said a thing. You
know, Susto plays Intuition Aleworks on Sunday, February 5th, in partnership with Flying Saucer. The performance is part of our JME Presents Music Discovery Series. You can find tickets on jacksmusic.org/events. Justin Osborne, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much for having me. We can't wait to come to Jacksonville, and we're stoked to be playing some shows with Howdy, too. He's the hometown boy and love his music.
Yeah,
so
Howdy.
It's going to be a fun show.
They sound great. You can look at the full transcript of Matt's talk with Justin Osborne of Susto at jacksmusic.org. And make sure to tune in to The Independent on 89.9 HD4. Discover new music from around the world and right here in the 904. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to David Luck and Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella Da Silva, and Michelle Corum. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll join you again today at noon for the Florida Roundup, our live statewide call-in program rounding up the biggest stories from all over the state. That's at noon. See you soon.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.